welcome to the podcast that is truly upsettingly powerful on an emotional level, Filmbookcast, the official podcast of filmbook.com. My name is Mike Smith. Joining me, as always, is a man who jumps every time he hears a clicking noise now.
Mike DiCriscio.
How you doing today, Mike?
I'm great. I'm sad that you put me on blast like that, but... But otherwise, I'm fine.
But also accurate, right?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, I'm not going to deny it. But I'm good.
Good, good, good. And also returning to the podcast is a guy who popped up in our Avengers review and then disappeared for a couple of episodes, much like the hobo from the Polar Express. It's Vin Craig. Welcome back to the show.
You guys demanded it, and here I am. You, yes. The audience, pulled it off. You got me back on the air.
You found me.
I was in a cabin, and it was snowing, and I had a big beard, and you said, we need you to do one more job.
Right.
That's exactly how it went down.
Yes, that's exactly how it went down. We actually did get a lot of positive feedback about your appearance last time, Vin, so we're excited to have you back.
Amazing. Thank you so much. That's good to hear.
Yeah, definitely. I definitely heard at least one person say you were funny, so that's good.
Was it Kyle?
No, it wasn't Kyle. It was somebody else. Actually, well, Kyle also said it, so two people.
That's right.
Oh,
that's
man,
right,
you're raking in the numbers.
And his ego exploded.
Now, if you've never listened to Filmbookcast before, first we start with some film news and then move on into some discussions where Mike and I, and also Vin this time around, each discuss whatever piece of media we've been consuming lately. And then after that, we move on into our feature review. This week, we are discussing the latest film from director Ari Aster, Hereditary. Now, me and Mike both saw it this weekend, and we were planning on reviewing it tonight. Vin, you texted me today saying, please let me be on your Hereditary review.
I had a feeling.
Yes.
And I meant to actually text you like 2 days ago, and I forgot. And then I remembered in a panic, and I Hail Mary'd the ball sending out that text. And you were like, yeah, come on. And I canceled plans with my elderly grandmother. Oh, no, I'm kidding.
Oh,
no. I'm kidding. I'm kidding.
Oh, no, that's too close to the movie.
No, I'm kidding.
I'm so scared right now.
Yeah,
super happy to be back.
Awesome. Oh, God, it's happening. No. It's all happening. All right, we gotta get out of this right now. Let's get into some film news.
Hi, it's time for...
All right, it's time for film news here on Filmbookcast. Now, we've got a few things to get through today, and the first has got to be one of the most anticipated sequels of our age, right? I think...
Shrek 5, here we go. Coming in hot.
Oh, God. You know what? I didn't even realize I was setting you up for a Shrek 5 joke.
Oh, come on.
You should always realize that. By the way, great bumper, you guys. I really appreciate the quality.
Every time.
We sit and listen to it quietly while you guys listen to it.
Yes. We all just sit here silently for a few seconds. Really, really soak in that bumper music, you know. Anyway, this highly anticipated sequel is not Shrek 5, but actually a few days ago, Tom Cruise posted the first image from Top Gun Maverick. It's officially happening. Top Gun 2 is actually a thing. Now, they've been talking about making Top Gun 2 for a really long time. Like, probably the better part of a decade. I think Tony Scott was making it at one point, but because he directed the original, but then he died. So now somebody else is making it. Joseph Kaczynski, the director of Tron Legacy, also directed Oblivion with Tom Cruise. Neither of which
two
I think
are... stellar movies.
I was about to say, neither of which I think are particularly great movies, so there's that. I did hear he did direct Only the Brave last year, which was the firefighter movie with Josh Brolin, which I heard was pretty good. Didn't see, but I do think his movies are pretty interesting on a visual level, at least. So Top Gun 2 has that going for it. But anyway, yeah,
it's just Top Gun in the Tron suits.
Well, actually, that, it's funny that you mentioned that because it seems like it's going to be about drone pilots. So,
oh, shit.
Yeah, well, I think it's going to be about drone pilots and how Tom Cruise is like, I'm the old guard, and like, the old ways are the better ways. These young kids with the drones these days can't handle it in the field, and then he'll be right at the end, and, you know, he'll do some crazy shit, and then Danger Zone will play, and then it'll end.
Now, would this be the original Danger Zone?
It probably won't be, actually. Kenny Loggins is supposedly recording a new version of Danger Zone.
Danger Zone.
I want to imagine that this movie is being made just to market the new version of Danger Zone.
I'm hoping it's like made to market like 10 more seasons of Archer, honestly. That's my...
If H. John Benjamin doesn't have a cameo, I'm going to be so
mad. My God.
He better be the voice of the drone.
Oh, the robot, the plane?
Yes, they should definitely do that. I mean, I think Kenny Loggins is also talking about this new version of Danger Zone. He wants to team up with another person to make it, like maybe like a younger pop artist or
Cardi B.
Or Cardi B. Could be Cardi B. You never know. I was thinking Judy Greer, because didn't they do like a duet of Danger Zone on Archer, her and Kenny Loggins?
Yes, I think they did, yeah.
So they should totally do that, because I think that would be amazing. I love Danger Zone. Very excited for the new
version.
Did like
an Outlaw Country version of it, I think.
Right, Outlaw Country. Mm-hmm. That should be the catchphrase of Top Gun 2, I think. Every character should just shout Outlaw Country before they before their plane explodes or something.
And they speed off into the sunset.
Guys, I don't mean to be insensitive here, but doesn't Val Kilmer only have half a face?
Well, you're jumping ahead a little bit here, Vin, because
well, no, it's not a plot point in the movie. It's a plot point in real life.
Well, I'm saying I haven't mentioned that Val Kilmer was coming back yet. You're jumping ahead.
Oh, man, Vin, you had one job.
No, you said, my God, no. I was reading a headline that said, let's see if Tom Cruise and Val Kilmer can pull it off again. And in my head, I was like, oh, Mike said that. I'm so sorry.
It's okay.
I'm coming back for his second and last appearance on the podcast.
Yeah, dude, get the fuck out of here right now. Val Kilmer is coming back to Top Gun 2 as well. So it's got Tom Cruise. Val Kilmer's back as Iceman. Goose, still dead, I believe, which is unfortunate.
Shame.
But yeah, and I'm a little surprised about Val Kilmer coming back. I'm sure it's probably like a glorified cameo, if anything else. I feel like it's mostly a Tom Cruise vehicle. But I don't know. Yeah, Val Kilmer hasn't really made a movie in a long time, or at least a movie that people have seen in a very long time. I think the last one was MacGruber, which doesn't fall into the movie people have seen category.
No, he was in The Snowman.
He was in The Snowman, although his voice was dubbed over in The Snowman. It wasn't his voice.
There's a lot going on in The Snowman.
What?
Yeah. I think, Val Kilmer might have had a stroke or something like that. Like, he lost half
his face. I'm not, like his jaw, half his jaw is, like, gone.
Okay, yeah. So
I don't know if you've seen him, but he does not look good.
Okay, I did not see The Snowman, so I haven't seen him. But, I haven't seen him in a little while. I'm pretty sure the last thing I saw of him was MacGruber, actually. But, they dubbed over his voice in The Snowman, so I'm curious if they'll do the same thing here. Although, actually, you know what? I think he posted something on Instagram recently. He seems to be doing a lot better. So we'll see what happens. You know, who knows what's going on with Val Kilmer. But the point is, he's coming back as Iceman, so that's, you know, it's something. As for the need for a Top Gun 2, like, I barely need Top Gun 1, so...
But you have a need for speed, and...
There it is.
Top Gun 2 is the answer. Prescription.
That's definitely the exact line. Go with it.
Yep.
mostly,
moving on.
Yeah, mostly.
Next story.
Yeah, mostly I just want Kenny Loggins' new Danger Zone. That's the big news for me, really. Next thing on the news, DC is still making movies and still just announcing stuff left and right without any kind of actual idea of what they're making.
Allegedly.
Yeah, so the new one is that DC is now making a Joker movie for Jared Leto. Who obviously played Joker in Suicide Squad. This is in addition to the non-Jared Leto Joker movie that they're making, which supposedly may star Joaquin Phoenix and is directed by Todd Phillips. This one has no director and no writer and no start date, so I don't know if this one will actually happen or if they're just saying this to, like, placate Jared Leto.
Jared, it's coming. It's coming.
Yeah, totally, man, totally. But it's weird, because in addition to this, they're also still sort of working on Suicide Squad 2. They're also doing that Harley Quinn Birds of Prey movie that they're talking about. So there's so many other DC movies that are all in the same kind of area. But then on top of that, they've got 20 other movies that they're also working on. And I still don't think like 75% of them are ever going to happen.
Yeah, no. And if they do come out, they'll be bad. I'll say it. I'll call my shot. Come at me, DC.
Yeah,
it's so sad, like, just how desperate DC Warner Brothers is to get movies, like, established, and they're just so bad.
Yeah, it's rough. It's a rough go out there for DC right now. That said, I am holding out hope for Aquaman. It's got that James Wan thing going for it, which, you know, I'm a fan of. I like James Wan. Wonder Woman 2 will probably be pretty good. Right, so there's
Wonder Woman so good.
Yeah, so Wonder Woman 2, like there's that happening, and then you know who knows how Shazam could turn out. Shazam could be good. You never know.
Yeah, with Chuck.
Yeah, with Chuck.
Yeah, sleeper hit Shazam.
Yeah, you know how they cast The Rock as the villain in Shazam and then didn't put him in the Shazam movie? That's
about the moment that I lost interest in the Shazam movie.
I mean, because The Rock really should be playing Shazam, first of all. Like, I feel like there's no reason he's not.
No, John Cena should be playing Shazam opposite The Rock's Black Adam.
That's also true. That was a rumor for a while.
And they should promote it with the same poster that they used to promote WrestleMania 25.
They shouldn't even call it Shazam. They should call it WrestleMania, like, 30 or whatever.
And just Photoshop in the costumes?
Yes. It's just WrestleMania with superpowers. Boom.
I'm in.
I would pay $20,000. I wouldn't pay that much. $10,000.
If I had $20,000 to throw away like that, yes, I would also pay $20,000.
It's exactly what I would spend it on. So yeah, I mean, DC making a Joker movie, I mean, do we want a Jared Leto Joker movie? I'm guessing no.
Hard no.
I don't know. It's going to be twisted because he's damaged. I don't know. That character's so bad. I was excited when Jared Leto was, like, announced as the Joker, and then I watched my hopes and dreams disappear like a hobo on top of a train, turning to dust and blowing away. We're back, baby.
Yeah, I'm surprised you were able to see how damaged the Joker was, considering how subtextual that was in the movie. But
Well, I could see the tattoo on his forehead. He can't. That's the thing. Is that he can't see that he's damaged.
Oh, wow. That's
masterfully crafted character work.
Oscar-worthy makeup also.
Yes.
Oh, apparently, yeah. And the Killer Croc that is such a racially sensitive character.
Okay.
Yeah, I think we're waiting on the Killer Croc movie next is the big announcement, I'm sure. It's got to be. Yep. So yeah, I think a Jared Leto Joker movie, bad idea. The Joaquin Phoenix Joker movie, slightly less bad idea. Still, I think, not a great idea.
I'm so into it, because at this point, like, whatever, you know? Like, yeah. You're going to go big or go home. They're like, can we get the guy from The Hangover? Yeah, because if anybody should helm a movie about the most iconic villain ever.
It's Todd Phillips.
And presumably he'll cameo as that singer in that band he always shows up as.
Oh, my God.
That
just sings, like, regular songs but with dirty words.
Yes.
Yeah.
Oh, and Joaquin Phoenix's Joker could kill him.
True, yeah, and that cameo could end forever. That would be interesting.
Yeah, that'd be cool, like Silent Bob and Moose Jaws. Sorry, I'm jumping all over the place right now.
And spoiling Moose Jaws, like, right out the gate.
No, Kevin Smith came out and was like, Silent Bob's going to die in Moose Jaws. And I was like, dude, you haven't even released Yoga Hoosers yet. Like, what are you doing?
Come on.
Yeah.
Seriously, though, Kevin, big fan.
Oh, yeah, yeah. Love Kevin Smith, hated Yoga Hoosers, but that's besides the point. Anyway, so that's the DC Joker news. And then I got some pretty big Game of Thrones news here, guys. Vin, are you a fan of Game of Thrones? I'm assuming you are.
Oh, yeah.
Okay, good. Yeah, me
I have a doorstop that says Hodor sitting on my mirror.
Do you really?
Yeah, I can actually get it. Hold on.
It's an audio medium, so it's not...
we believe you.
Oh, he's actually getting it. He's getting it.
Okay.
Yep. He's standing up.
This is for you guys. This is for the people at home. They need to see this.
Yeah, okay. Yeah, he's right. It does say Hodor.
Yeah, I like it.
He was not lying. So, okay, so you're a Game of Thrones fan, and yeah. So are we. So, obviously, Game of Thrones, hugely successful show for HBO, and HBO wants to keep that train running because Game of Thrones is almost over. They have one last season to go. So they have been in the process of working on, like, four different scripts that could all be spinoffs or prequels or what have you to the Game of Thrones mythos, and now HBO has finally ordered one of those scripts to a pilot phase, and it will take place 10,000 years before the events of Game of Thrones. So basically, I don't think it will have much relation to Game of Thrones other than it's also a fantasy show.
I guess.
I'm in. Yeah, I mean, I don't know. I haven't read the books or anything like that, so I don't know much about the, like, deep lore history within Game of Thrones, but I know there isn't a lot there. There's, like, a whole history textbook that you can get.
Yeah, like a Silmarillion, but for Game
but
of Thrones.
For, like, young nerds, I guess.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. A modern Silmarillion.
Yeah, it sounds a lot like Knights of the Old Republic, the Star Wars video game prequel that takes place thousands of years before
That.
Knights of the Old Gods Republic, I'm going to call this from now on. That's my hilarious Game of Thrones reference for the day. But anyway, here's what the synopsis on Entertainment Weekly posted. It says, taking place thousands of years before the events of Game of Thrones, the series chronicles the world's descent from the golden age of heroes into its darkest hour. And only one thing is for sure, from the horrifying secrets of Westeros' history to the true origin of the White Walkers, the mysteries of the East to the Starks of legend, it's not the story we think we know. Yes. As we know, prequels that show the origins of things we like are always good. So,
Show me the thing I love as a baby.
This is obviously a can't fail proposition.
I just feel like Knights of the Old Republic works because in episode one of Star Wars, which is the first Star Wars movie that ever was released,
The Phantom Menace, the original.
The first one. It's the Jedi, like, but there's only a couple of them left. So it makes sense to go back to the heyday when there's, like, more of these cool guys.
Right.
With Game of Thrones, it's like, oh, remember Knights? Yeah, well, we got them, but just, you know, further in the past.
I mean, it's sort of the same. You can make the same argument, I think. They always talk about the Black Watch and how they're Night's Watch and how there's, like, you know, 100 of them left. They used to be tens of thousands of them and all this stuff on the wall and all these things.
Right.
If you want to make, like, a good point, yeah, I guess that's fair.
But that said, like, do we really need it, though? I don't know. Want to keep printing that Westerosi money.
Maybe. Mm-hmm. I mean, I'm a little cynical on the prospect just because I think we just reviewed Solo, A Star Wars Story, and we had a lot of criticisms about that movie that were based around the fact that it was just, you know, explaining origin things that I didn't care about. So to hear they are going to explore the true origin of the White Walkers, like the White Walkers might just be more interesting as this malevolent force that we don't know that much about, you know? Mm-hmm. So we'll see what happens. I mean, I'm interested in it. It's Game of Thrones, so I'll probably check it out.
I'll watch it.
Yeah. Also worth noting, Jane Goldman is the showrunner of this show. So she has been Matthew Vaughn's writing partner for a number of years. She co-wrote Kick-Ass, the Kingsman movies, and a lot of good stuff. So I'm interested in that aspect of this Game of Thrones show, and that perfectly segues into my final story for film news.
Captain Segway strikes again.
That was flawless.
Thank you. Thank you. Matthew Vaughn, Jane Goldman's writing partner, is the director of such films as Kick-Ass and Kingsman: The Secret Service, is actually planning a new semi-reboot of Kick-Ass based on the new comic. And he's also working on a shitload of new Kingsman movies, too. So I wanted to bring this up a little bit because I think it's kind of interesting, but also because, Mike, you and I talked about Kick-Ass a few weeks ago for The Complete Works. We just got to that episode for our Nicolas Cage podcast.
Okay, you cunts. Let's see what you can do now. Eeny, meeny, miny, moe.
So would you guys be interested in a new Kick-Ass that would theoretically kind of take place in the same universe as the first two movies, but, you know, focus on new characters?
I think so, because, we talked about in Kick-Ass that, in our review for it, that it came out in, what was it, 2008 or something like that? Or
2010.
Around there? 2010, okay. Well, I mean, it might as well all be the same thing. But, like, it was right on the cusp, right? It just was just too early for, like, the modern superhero movie era that we're in right now, where every third movie is a tentpole superhero movie. So, like, I would be down to see that kind of, like, postmodern skewering of the genre now. But hopefully it's just not the same thing. Is what I would be afraid of.
Yeah.
I really like the original Kick-Ass. I just think leave well enough alone. Like, are they going to bring back Aaron Taylor Johnson?
I don't think so. I think it's going to be focused on the new comic, which is based on, and I don't know that much about it, but I think it's based on a new character who is inspired by Kick-Ass, who kind of takes on the mantle. So there's that. Also, Matthew Vaughn's talking about doing, like, a Hit Girl movie, too, which, you know, that would be...
Okay.
That would be cool. Into that. Yeah. I think the boat has... The ship has kind of sailed on that, whereas, like, I feel like if Chloe Moretz was still, like, 12 years old, I'd be like, yes, do a Hit Girl movie. Like, make this happen. Now that she's, like, you know, almost 20, it's the novelty is worn off a little bit, I feel like.
Well, she's busy remaking, like, every horror movie ever.
Because she was in Let Me In, and that's the one that I can think of?
No, she's in Let Me In. She was Carrie and Carrie, and now going to be in the remaking Suspiria.
Oh, shit, she is in that. Okay, yeah, you're right.
don't think I didn't fact check that before I made that joke.
Yeah, fair.
Not even a joke, just a truth-based observation.
Just a reference, yes. You're right. She is remaking a lot of horror movies, which is interesting. But I don't know if this Hit Girl movie would actually happen. I think what's happening is that Matthew Vaughn is taking his Marv Studios and kind of putting it into an independent arm. So he's going to be separate from the studios and stuff like that. So he's taking these properties that he already has access to, the Kick-Ass and Kingsman, and kind of building them out from there. So I don't know if he'd actually end up directing Kick-Ass, this reboot, or whatever, if he'd just be producing it. I would hope if he's going to make it that he would direct it, because I remember Kick-Ass 2 was not a very good movie, and I feel like it was largely because Matthew Vaughn didn't direct it. It was, his style was sorely missing from that. Now, that said, I think Kingsman, the first Kingsman, is Matthew Vaughn's best movie. Kingsman 2, I'm a little hit or miss on, but it still is like a solid amount of fun. And he is working on a shitload of new ones. I mean, he's got Kingsman 3 in the works, obviously. And I think of all the movies that we're talking about today, I think that's the most likely one that he'll actually direct, at least next. Mm-hmm. He's also working on a prequel about the origins of Kingsman. So, again, always a great idea. More prequels, people. He's also working on a spinoff about the Statesman from Kingsman 2, the American version with like Channing Tatum and Jeff Bridges.
Oh, I'm so sorry, Jeff Bridges.
Friend of the show, Jeff Bridges.
Yeah.
Friend of the show, friend of the pod.
Yes, and he's also working on some kind of TV show about Kingsman as well. So I don't know. I mean, I think of all those, is there anything out of there that jumps out at you that you would want to see?
Yeah, I'm excited for Kingsman 5, specifically.
So you're not excited about any of these. You're waiting for the movie like 3 or 4 movies from now.
Uh-huh. Yep.
All right.
This is all very truthful. It's not doing a bit right now. No, I don't know, man. I feel like once you get oversaturated with something, it's going to – like Kingsman was cool because it was like an interesting take on that James Bond genre where they kind of skewered it a little bit. And then Kingsman 2, I was like, all right, let's roll the dice. Let's see what happens. And it was kind of cool, the parts of it that I saw, which were not all of it.
Did you see any of it?
Some would say no. Some would say I haven't seen any of that movie and I'm speaking out my butt.
I mean, that was expert bullshitting, so well done.
Thank you so much.
If I had a hat, I would tip it.
Yeah. Yeah, we reviewed Kingsman 2, so we have both seen that movie.
Mm-hmm. I'm down for Kingsman 3, I think. Out of all those movies you talked about, I'm sort of interested in Statesman. Only because that felt so underdeveloped and like kind of just bleh in Kingsman 2. To see that be kind of actually handled and taken care of and crafted into a full story about what those guys are, I would be interested in. Because, Kingsman is such a take on like British spy espionage action movies. To see the like an actual hot take version of that on the American version, I would probably be into.
Yeah, definitely.
Do we have an answer to James Bond?
Mission Impossible, man. That's our James Bond. I would say so. True. I can't think of maybe Jason Bourne, right?
I was thinking that too, yeah.
Yeah.
Although he's, probably more. I think Mission Impossible.
Yeah, I feel like Mission Impossible.
There's so many more of them.
Well, there's one more of them.
Yeah.
It just feels also, like a lot.
There's two. Well, I guess I can't argue that there's two Bournes because there's like 9 Bonds.
Yeah, I would say Mission Impossible is probably the closest American analog to James Bond. I mean, I think in terms of the actual like stunts and the over the top nature of it, Jason Bourne is more like the. The Daniel Craig Bonds really took after the Bournes in a big way, in terms of like the low stakes hand to hand combat kind of thing and the shaky cam and all that. But I feel like in terms of what I think of as classical James Bond, Mission Impossible is the one that comes to mind. Although, actually, Man from U.N.C.L.E. from a couple years ago, that was basically a James Bond movie. It was like set in the 60s and kind of felt like an old school kind of James Bond adventure. But as an ongoing franchise, Mission Impossible to me would be the American version of that.
Oh, yeah, hands down.
I like it.
Yeah. But, anyway, I think that about wraps up our film news. So let's move on into our discussions, starting right now.
Watch this. These are my discussions. Just when I thought I said all I could say, my buddy and I talk about movies we see. These are my discussions. There is so much to see, you and me. So we're gonna talk about movies for our discussions.
All right, it's time for our discussions here in Film Bookcast. So let's go through one by one. Mike, let's start with you. What do you have to discuss with us today?
I have actually a few things to discuss. Two I'm going to mention real quick. First one. I finished American Vandal. Mike, you forced me to watch the whole season. I finished the back 5 episodes, whatever it was. Oh my God, if you like true crime documentaries, this is the perfect send-up of that genre. Netflix roasted themselves. Good job.
Yes, so fucking good.
Yeah, incredible. Second thing is I watched L.A. Confidential for the first time, which is a kind of a neo-noir. Well, I guess it's just neo-noir, whatever. It came out in the 90s.
Yeah.
Kevin Spacey, Guy Pearce, oh my God, everybody. There's a million people in it, so many
Russell
I forgot.
Russell Crowe, Kim Basinger.
Russell Crowe. Yeah, that's the one I forgot. the grandpa from Babe, he's great.
Oh, James Caan?
James Cromwell.
James Cromwell. James Cromwell.
I wish James Caan was in this movie. But yeah, dirty cop detective 1950s movie. Great, awesome stuff. Watch it.
Yes, great movie.
But the big thing I want to talk about, or the main movie I want to talk about, is 1979's Quadrophenia.
Okay, now you watched this kind of because of me, right, Mike?
Yeah, you directly inspired me. I was looking for a movie to watch. You just recently saw Roger Daltrey and the New York Pops, or some symphony, I believe.
Right? The Hudson Valley Orchestra. So it was Roger Daltrey performed all of Tommy with an orchestra behind him at Bethel Woods recently, which is where Woodstock took place. So it was kind of cool because it's like the Who played at Woodstock. Roger Daltrey was there. Yes. It was like kind of cool scene. But yeah, I saw Roger Daltrey perform Tommy, which is one of my favorite albums. And yeah, I posted like some pictures on Instagram and you saw them. And magic was made.
Yeah, I was browsing Filmstruck. So Quadrophenia is available to watch on Filmstruck. So you get that dank Criterion joint if you have that. Mm. Yeah, and this is Quadrophenia is the story of a young guy. Oh, it's directed. Sorry, directed by Frank Rodman and starring Phil Daniels. Phil Daniels plays Jimmy, who's this kind of late teens, early 20s mod in 1970s London. Or maybe it's not London, actually. I don't remember exactly where it is. England somewhere. the big climax happens in Brighton. I remember that.
Sure.
And it's him and his group of friends, and just their kind of rebellious, debaucherous, apathetic life. It reminded me a lot of Trainspotting.
Okay.
Where it's this close group of friends just devolving in Quadrophenia. It's taking pills. There's a big scene where they break into a pharmacy and they're so messed up they don't know what ones they need to steal, and it's like this whole big thing,
right?
And it's pretty intense. I wasn't sure what to expect. I haven't seen Tommy the movie, but from what I understand, it's like an actual rock opera musical movie.
Oh yeah, that's great. Mm-hmm.
So I wasn't sure if that's what this was going to be, but it's not. It's just a kind of straight ahead slice of life drama about this group of disaffected young adults going through some shit in the late 70s. The album Quadrophenia kind of lays this like backdrop where we never really hear a full song. Like there's this really incredible montage in Brighton where they are, where Jimmy is like meandering the beach because it's like this beach town, but it's England, so it's gray and windy and cold. And the outro to Rain Over Me is playing. Like that's right. The only part of that, But it does kind of climax into this big brawl. Between the mods and the rockers, and the rockers are like the motorcycle riding, leather jacket wearing, like greaser kids,
nice.
Which is wild. Sting is in it for like 12 minutes,
yep.
Which is awesome. but we do the last like 20 minutes or so are kind of this philosophical. I don't know how to phrase it, but this is where we actually see like a large chunk of the album does play, where
oh,
we
cool.
just follow Jimmy as he just kind of goes through the motions at the end of the movie. So it is really cool. People should check it out. And that's Quadrophenia.
Cool. Yeah, I am nice. a huge fan of The Who. I saw Quadrophenia when I was like maybe 16 or something. I haven't seen it since, but I really would like to watch it again. I really like that movie. I think I preferred the movie A Version of Tommy, though, which is really great. Roger Daltrey plays Tommy in that movie. Elton John sings Pinball Wizard. It's awesome.
It's so good.
Yeah,
I've seen that scene so many times.
Yeah, so much fun. So much fun. So, Vin, what do you got to discuss with us today? What's on your agenda here?
Let me set the scene for you. It was 1 a.m., and I was very warm in my room. Is that awkward stage between the air conditioning being on and the windows being open?
Sure.
And I was like, man, what's like something I can really just kind of get into right now? And I put on Godzilla Planet of the Monsters on Netflix, and let me tell you, it is bad. It is. I'm not like, I like Godzilla conceptually.
Sure.
Like, I like the idea of kaiju and Godzilla. Like, I like big monsters. I haven't seen a lot of the original Godzilla movies, but I don't... Do they fight Godzilla in those?
In a lot of them, yes. I mean, it's...
But doesn't he eventually become the good guy? Well, and like, the audience is supposed to root for him?
There's no hard and fast continuity in the Godzilla movies. I think that's the first...
the Godzilla-verse?
The Godzilla-verse, yes.
The GCU?
Yeah, the GCU.
he's often the, like, misunderstood... you know, character where, like, the humans are trying to destroy him, but also he's trying to help the humans and all
right.
that stuff.
And sometimes...
Yeah, this movie gets rid of all of that.
Okay.
And they're like, this is Godzilla. He likes killing people. Here's your main character. He's rebelling against the people he's with because he wants to go square up and throw hands with Godzilla. And everybody's like, that's not a good idea.
Because you're a human, presumably.
Yeah. And he's basically a what happened... Yeah, of course. You know, you get it. He didn't get it. So, like, it's Godzilla shows up on Earth with all these monsters. I don't remember why. And then humans are like, well, we got to get out of this planet. And they do. And then they light speed travel. Now, I'm not a science man, but I think the way light speed works is when your light speed – traveling at light speed, time goes slower for you. So that makes it like when you arrive at your destination, more time will have passed in real time than passed for you who is traveling at light speed.
Yes, correct.
That sounds like an interstellar.
Yeah, exactly. So they get to Earth and they're like, it's been 10,000 years. He's probably gone. And then like the next scene, they're like, actually, it's more like 16,000 years. He's definitely gone. And then like the next like sentence, they're like, actually, it's been more like 20,000 years. So the movie can't keep... itself together, but then sure enough, they get back to the planet, and they're like, all right, we're just going down there just to see if it's livable. And that the kid, they send the kid, the main character, and he's like, yeah, all right, I'll follow orders. And I'm sitting here like, no, he's not. And then they go down there, and like the first like hour of the movie is them not on Earth. And okay. It's just like space debates.
Okay.
And then they get to Earth and they like find Godzilla and they just try to kill him and they don't. It's not good. It's... And it sets up a sequel because they're like, maybe there's more than one Godzilla. And then like maybe another Godzilla shows up. Like maybe they killed a Godzilla but not the Godzilla.
Okay. Interesting. Yeah.
I mean, check it out. It's bad.
Okay. I mean, I love Godzilla, and I haven't watched this. I'm not really, like, generally speaking, I don't watch a ton of animated stuff based on stuff I like. But so this is an anime movie, right? It's like Japanese animation.
Yeah, it's like a CG anime.
Okay. And I know...
It's like one of those weird hybrids.
And I believe the plan is that, yeah, they're going to make, like, two or three of these movies. I thought they were also making, like, a TV show or something on Netflix.
I hope not.
Hopefully it's not the same people, at least.
Fair enough. I would recommend, I mean, I talked about this during our Avengers review, so maybe you remember this. I would recommend checking out Shin Godzilla, the movie that
yes.
came out a couple years ago. Because it's sort of similar to what you were saying. It is just them fighting Godzilla. A lot of it is just, like, you know, bureaucrats talking to each other for, like, an hour and 20 minutes. But I found it really engaging and interesting. And, like, it's a lot more snappy. It's snappy and funny. And also the Godzilla stuff is fantastic, so... I would recommend.
Yeah, I've seen some clips from that after we talked about it, like when, like before he evolves,
right?
Like when he's just crawling around like a slippery little snake,
slippery little Godzilla,
slippery. I see you there, slipping around, Godzilla. Yeah, but then also I feel like there's one other thing that I noticed about this movie that was just so dumb. Oh yeah, and it's like right in the beginning when they're going through the opening montage of what happened to Earth, this alien race shows up. And they're like, oh my, like we see, you know, our home planet was destroyed and we're going to help you if you like, but once we get Godzilla out of here, you got to give us your planet. And the humans are like, yes, do it. Get him out of here. And then like within like 30 seconds, it's just like one guy sitting in a control room for the aliens with his hand on his head being like, we can't do this. Like we can't beat him.
Amazing.
And Godzilla seemingly can travel anywhere in an instant.
Yeah, that's always been his thing.
Yeah, that's fair. So there was that movie. Also, Game Night with Jason Bateman and Rachel McAdams.
Yes.
Incredible movie. I'm going to call it right now. We're halfway through the year. I'm going to say it's probably going to end in my top 10 on the year.
Wow. Yeah, I also like Game Night a lot. I saw that a few months back. I talked about it on the podcast, I think. But yeah, super funny movie. I actually just bought it on Amazon on Blu-ray because it's like $10 right now. So if you're looking to take advantage of a super good deal, that's it's
what
it's
a well deal.
Worth it. Yeah.
And we don't even get any cut for that. Like, we don't get any of that money.
Right. Yeah, we don't get any of that sweet Game Night Blu-ray money. Until now, yeah. Maybe.
Maybe. Amazon, looking at you.
Use coupon code FilmBookCast at checkout for an error message saying that's not a valid coupon.
By the way, this podcast is brought to you by Squarespace. Squarespace, you'll look beautiful.
All right, Paul Scheer.
Anyway, I've got a few movies I wanted to discuss today, and they're all recent stuff. The first is called Upgrade.
Can I have everybody's attention?
I'm looking for the guys who murdered my wife. Are you one of them?
Yeah.
Stanley can take over.
Thank you. I now have full control.
Hi.
You upgraded. Now you're stronger.
Which is the new movie from director Lee Whannell, who's kind of a protege of James Wan. He helped produce the Saw movies and the Insidious movies. I think he directed Insidious 3 or 4, one of the Insidious sequels. Anyway, this is his second movie, and it's a very solid B-movie sci-fi ripoff of John Wick.
Nice.
That's the vibe I got. Is that Blumhouse, by the way?
I think it is. I want to say it is. I might be wrong on that, but I'm pretty sure it is.
It is, yeah.
Okay, and it's about a guy who gets an AI implant in his brain that takes over his body and helps him take revenge on the people who killed his wife. So it's literally John Wick, but with like a sci-fi twist. And Logan Marshall Green stars as the main character, and he's pretty good. You know, I think he's been written off a lot in his career as like discount Tom Hardy, because he looks a lot like Tom Hardy. But which, you know, reasonable. But he's very solid. Like, this is the biggest showcase he's ever had. If you don't know who he is, he was one of the scientists in Prometheus. And he was also the first Shocker in Spider-Man Homecoming, the one who gets vaporized by the Vulture.
Turns to dust.
Yes. And he's very good in this movie. He's very funny, like interacting with STEM, the AI implant. It's got some great action sequences. It's super violent. And the ending is very good, very unexpected, and very nihilistic. So... I was into that. It felt like the kind of like the almost John Carpenter-ish in the way that like the tone of the movie kind of strikes. Like it felt like something that could have existed in the 80s or 70s and would be like a cult classic today. So definitely, I would recommend Upgrade. I think it's a pretty cool action movie. I also saw Ocean's 8.
And we are going to rob it, not the ball itself, on the neck of Daphne Kluger,
valued at over $100 million.
$150 million, actually.
The new Ocean's spinoff / sequel. This one's directed by Gary Ross, subbing in for Steven Soderbergh. Gary Ross is a guy who's made some pretty good movies. I mean, he's made Pleasantville, and I like Pleasantville a lot. He also made Seabiscuit and The Hunger Games, which, you know, are fine, whatever. Gary Ross is a guy who I think mostly makes like totally fine, passable entertainment, and I think that's exactly what he does here. You know, I enjoy it. So this is the all-female reboot of Oceans. I didn't even mention that before, but this is an all-female team. Sandra Bullock, Cate Blanchett, Anne Hathaway, Mindy Kaling, Rihanna, Awkwafina, Helena Bonham Carter, and Sarah Paulson. And that was all memory, by the way. I'm very happy with myself.
Nice.
Yeah, that was impressive.
Yeah, it's a great cast. Like, a phenomenal cast of actresses in this movie. And I enjoyed watching them on screen together. Like, it's more of a hangout movie than it is a heist movie in some ways. Like, I feel like a lot of it is just them, like... Did you see Ocean's 8, Ben? Are you...
Oh, no, I'm just saying, like, that makes sense.
Oh, yeah. Okay, so I feel like it's... Because it doesn't have the energy that, like, Soderbergh brings to it, and it doesn't have the as tight a script as the Ocean's movies used to have. It mostly is just, like, a hangout movie with these characters. Like, it, you know, you see this cast bouncing off each other, and they're having fun, and so, like, I'm having fun because they're having fun kind of thing. But I remember, I think it was, like, either Roger Ebert or Gene Siskel, who had a quote once years ago that I think about every once in a while, and it was something like, the movie that I'm watching has to be better than the movie I have in my head of just the same actors having lunch together on set, something along those lines. And I feel like I'm not sure this is better than just watching those actresses having lunch together on set. You know what I mean? You know what I mean?
Yeah.
I like that.
did the con have its pros?
That's a good reference to the tagline of this movie. Good job.
It's such a good tagline.
It is a good tagline. But yeah, and the thing is, it's a very conflict-free... Like, I feel like with these kind of heist movies, I feel like the Ocean's movies are always very breezy about their heists. Like, they always seem to go really well, really easily. But I think the Soderbergh ones give you, like, the illusion of conflict, and this one does not. There's like things go very easily pretty much the entire time. I will say Anne Hathaway, fantastic in this movie. She's great. I've always been a big fan of Anne Hathaway. Like, I think there was a backlash against her for a long time, but she's great in this movie, playing like a version of herself. So she's not playing herself, but she's playing like basically an analog for a lot of different like Hollywood starlets. And so she's good in the movie. There's also like some surprising cameo, like the Ocean's movies always had cameos, and this one has some cameos, also including some cameos from previous Ocean's characters, although not the ones that you would expect to be in the movie. So there's that. All I'm saying is I've seen Matt Damon cameo in three separate movies over the past year, and he's not in the fucking Ocean's movie.
Fun fact, he was. They filmed a cameo, yes, and it got cut.
Yeah, he did get cut.
That's amazing.
Yeah, so that's a bummer. It also feels like it's building up to a George Clooney cameo that never comes. Yeah, and I'm not totally, like, they referenced this character a few times, and I'm not totally sure I like what they did with this character, and I don't really feel like I can get into that without going into spoilers. So I'll just leave it at that. But yeah, Ocean's 8, totally fine, passable entertainment. I enjoyed it, not as much as I hoped I would. And then I saw First Reformed also.
Jesus didn't want our suffering. He suffered for us. Mm-hmm. He wants our commitment and our obedience.
And what of his creation? The heavens declare the glory of God. God is present everywhere, in every plant, every river, every tiny insect. The whole world is a manifestation of his holy presence. I think this is an issue where the church can lead, but they say nothing. The U.S. Congress still denies climate change. Where were we when these people were elected?
Which is the new movie directed by Paul Schrader, who was the writer of Scorsese movies like Taxi Driver, Raging Bull, Last Temptation of Christ, and Bringing Out the Dead, and has directed several movies over the course of his career as well. This is fantastic. First Reformed is incredible. It feels very much of a piece with the stuff he did with Scorsese. Ethan Hawke plays a preacher having a crisis of faith and questioning man's impact on the earth. And he is incredible in this movie. Ethan Hawke is unreal. Also, Cedric the Entertainer is in this movie.
I heard that.
And,
what?
You know, this movie opened with the opening credits, and it said, like, starring Ethan Hawke, Amanda Seyfried, and Cedric Kyles. And I was like, wow, I wonder who Cedric Kyles is that he gets top billing with Ethan Hawke and Amanda Seyfried. And then the movie, like, rolls on, and suddenly Cedric the Entertainer pops up, and I was like, what? Because I was taken aback, and then I realized
that's his first billing as not Mr. the Entertainer.
First time I've seen him as not Mr. the Entertainer. So there's that. And he is.
Please, Mr. the Entertainer was my father. Yeah. Call me Cedric. I'm sorry. I'm so sorry. Yeah.
But he is surprisingly great in this movie. He's very good. And, you know, I've been thinking about this movie a lot over the past few days. Basically, when I'm not thinking about Hereditary, which is pretty frequently, I'm thinking about First Reformed. That's basically. My entire last couple of days have just been thinking about these two movies. And then finally, there's one more movie I wanted to talk about, and that's called The Tale, which is directed by Jennifer Fox, and it played at Sundance back in January, and I heard phenomenal things about it at Sundance, and then it got acquired by HBO, and HBO premiered it a few weeks back, and I feel like it kind of got buried because people just didn't know that it was coming out. So it's an autobiographical film about the director Jennifer Fox, in which Laura Dern plays Jennifer Fox as she digs through her memories and talks to people from her past to make sense of the sexual assault that she experienced when she was 13. And this movie is incredible. I mean, it's an incredibly told story, hitting at, I think, just the right moment. And it's very disturbing, but it feels very vital and important. And it feels like more people need to watch it, but won't because it's on HBO and it kind of got buried. So I would say watch it. It's great. I enjoyed all the movies that I talked about today, but I think First Reformed and The Tale are the ones I feel like people should definitely go see. And that, I think, wraps up my discussions, unless you guys have anything else you wanted to throw in there. I see Vin raising his finger questioningly.
I have one more thing, and you just jogged my memory. Okay. I watched today Cameron Esposito's new stand-up special, Rape Jokes.
I heard about this. So she was on this podcast I listened to called Good One, which is a podcast about jokes. And so she just explained the whole thesis behind the special. I have not watched it, though. How was it?
It's fascinating. She's very funny, and it's I've never seen anything like it. I've never seen a stand-up. I've never seen a woman do stand-up like that.
Okay.
And I don't mean to say it like – it's incredible. I've seen amazing female comedians, but there was just like – she left it all out there, and it was so earnest, and it was so like raw, And it's very funny.
Cool. Yeah, definitely. Yeah, I want to check that out. That's on vulture.com, I think, right? That's where that's that.
No, it's on her website.
Oh, really?
It's free, but you could also make a donation.
Okay, cool.
If you're so inclined.
Cool. Yeah, I'll definitely.
I did not. Because I don't got it like that. If I had it, I would have.
Right. If you had, the money.
20,000 bones.
Right.
Yeah, laying around. I'll kick her a couple.
Anyway, yeah, I do want to check out that special. And yeah, if you haven't heard that podcast, definitely check that out, because she talks about the whole process and behind the making of it. It's pretty fascinating.
Oh, for sure.
And I think that wraps up our discussions, guys. So let's move on into our featured review of Hereditary.
It's heartening to see so many strange new faces here today. I know my mom would be very touched and probably a little suspicious. My mother was a very secretive and private woman. It's Grandma. You know you were her favorite, right? Even when you were a little baby, she wouldn't let me feed you because she needed to feed you. She was a very difficult woman, which maybe explains me.
I recognize you from your mother.
What? Sometimes I swear I can feel them in the room.
Oh my God! What's that?
She isn't gone.
All right, that was from the trailer for Hereditary, the new movie written and directed by Ari Aster. It stars Toni Collette, Alex Wolff, Millie Shapiro, Ann Dowd, and Gabriel Byrne, among others. And the IMDb plot synopsis for Hereditary reads, when the matriarch of the Graham family passes away, her daughter's family begins to unravel cryptic and increasingly terrifying secrets about their ancestry. So, guys, we all saw Hereditary this past weekend. What were we expecting going into this movie? What did you heard going into Hereditary? Either way.
I saw, I think, the trailer once before something. I can't remember which movie. Something we reviewed recently, probably. And it freaked me the fuck out in that it's just a bunch of really weird imagery. And after that, I sort of took pains to not watch the trailer again. Or, you know, like, change the channel for commercials, because I sort of had a feeling we were going to be talking about it on here.
Yeah.
And, you know, I've often talk about being unsullied when it comes to movies, right?
Yeah, fair.
Especially when it comes to horror movies, or like, cerebral movies, things that I want to go in with as few preconceived notions as possible. So I didn't really know what to expect going in. So I'm interested to hear, like, how you guys approached this movie.
Yeah, Van, what about you? How did you, when you were walking into Hereditary, what were your expectations?
I thought it was going to be a movie where Toni Collette was the main character, and I thought it was going to be more of a jump scare movie, which it is not.
No, definitely it's not that. I had heard about this a while back. It played at Sundance, and I remember hearing good things about it then. And then as it got closer to release, I just remember hearing, like the reviews started coming out, and everybody seemed to be like hyping up this movie a lot, like got like really really positive reviews all around, and I started getting kind of hyped for it. I was pretty into it. I saw the trailer a few times, and yeah, like you, I was trying to avoid it, but I saw it like more than a few times. But I feel like the trailer does a pretty good job of just showing you like, you know, scary imagery, but not revealing like story points of the movie, which is
does not show its hand.
Yeah, so that's good. I also did know that this was a movie by A24, and A24 has been doing some pretty great stuff with horror lately. They released The Witch 2 years ago, which I loved.
And, so good.
They did It Comes at Night, which I also liked with
less good.
Yeah, less good, but still pretty solid. So I was pretty excited on that front. A24 in general, I think, is probably the best studio working today right now. I was looking through some of their past films, like over the past couple of years, and like, I mean, just last year they had like Lady Bird, Florida Project, Disaster Artist. Year before that they had like Moonlight and The Witch and Swiss Army Man, and so much great stuff.
I think they did Ex Machina.
They did that, and they had the end of the tour, and they basically, and they, this company started in like 2013. Like
yeah.
This is only like 5 years old, and they already have a best picture winning movie under their belt. And several other nominations and stuff like that. They did Room also. Yeah, I was pretty excited for Hereditary after all that. Mike, you saw this before me. I planned to see it Saturday night, and then that didn't end up happening. I ended up seeing it Monday, but you saw it on Sunday, and I knew you had seen it because you texted me, "Holy fuck, bra!" in all caps, and I was like, "Oh, I guess he must have saw Hereditary."
Yep.
And you did, and so the next day I saw it, and I texted you. I wasn't even thinking about the fact that you had texted me, "Holy fuck, bro!" But like, I just felt like I needed to get it out there. I needed to tell somebody that like I saw it, and so I just texted you, "Jesus fucking Christ, dude!"
Yes.
And it was just like, and we just knew, right? We just knew, mm-hmm. just knew that mm-hmm. it was hereditary. I'll start with you guys. Vin, since you're the guest, why don't you go first? What are your overall thoughts on Hereditary?
I think it's an incredibly well-paced movie that builds its tension nonstop from the opening scene till the credits roll. I don't know if it's spoilery or not.
Just remember we have a spoiler section, so don't if you're on the fence, we could save it, don't worry.
But it's not a spoiler of the specifics. I just felt like this movie had a happy ending.
Interesting.
And that was what my first comment when the credits started to roll. I leaned over to my buddy and I was like, was that a happy ending? Like, were those the people we were supposed to be rooting for this whole time?
And your friend kind of looked at you like, what the fuck is wrong with you?
Yeah, kind of like you guys are looking at me now. I think that Gabriel Byrne is like so underused in this movie.
Okay.
I think the moments he gets are amazing. Toni Collette kills it, and it's a fascinating film.
Okay, definitely. Mike,
also,
God damn it. Yeah.
All right, Mike, what's your take on Hereditary?
Hereditary is a movie that I don't know if I've ever been this deeply and profoundly shook by. I came into work on Monday after seeing, right, I saw it Sunday night. And I told my coworkers, I was like, holy shit, I saw Hereditary last night. And people were like, what movie? And I was like, I have to sit here for 8 hours and pretend I'm all right. Like, I can't talk to anybody about this movie right now. Like, what? But yeah, this movie is a astounding first effort from this writer-director. Toni Collette should get an Oscar. I'm really hoping.
That's what I was thinking too.
After the outpouring of love for Get Out last year, I'm hoping this horror movie gets some love come next Oscar season. And yeah, it is a beautifully crafted, just knife in the gut, just twisting for 2 hours and 10 minutes, very slowly working its way to your heart. And then it just is like, oh, here we are, and you're dead. And it's
that just depends on whose side you take.
Yeah, okay, fair. This is the state of my mind has been for the last 48 hours.
Right.
Where, like, I can't really form complete sentences about it.
Just incoherent babbling. That's your take on Hereditary.
And, like, I'm just going to say, I don't know if you guys have noticed in my camera, there's a lot of dark, black, empty space over here, and I've been freaked out the whole time we've been recording.
Well, now that you pointed it out.
Oh, do you not see that person?
Yeah, stop.
Now that you pointed it out, I'm going to be freaked out. This is an unfriended situation.
Yeah, we have to look at that. You don't have to look at that dark corner.
I can see it. It's scary.
Oh, right. That's how Skype works.
Why didn't you turn a light on in your room?
Because, like, mood lighting. Because
he's a bachelor.
But, yeah, it's incredible. This movie, it all the things it evokes. Sorry, Mike. I didn't mean to jump back into an actual serious review.
Sure.
All the movies it evokes, you know, in the horror genre are, like, some of the best horror movies of all time. Like, The Shining and Rosemary's Baby.
Definitely.
And things like these are pillars within the modern horror genre that this movie is like, yeah, we can do those things too and just as well. And it's insane.
With the finger guns that you just did.
Finger guns. That's how confident they are.
Yes.
Finger guns surprisingly does not play a big part in the movie.
Right. Yeah. I mean, that's disappointingly, really, I think, is what you meant.
Severe lack of finger guns.
Now, I know that I am occasionally prone to hyperbole when discussing movies on this podcast and on Twitter and stuff. It was recently pointed out to me that I really often say, this person's one of the greatest blanks working today. Like, apparently I say that a lot, or something along those lines. I get it. I am being completely 100% serious. This is not hyperbole. I think Hereditary might be the absolute best horror movie this decade. And the only one that I think comes close is The Babadook. It's a close race between those two movies. I love both very much. But Hereditary is such a confident debut film. And Rosemary's Baby is the movie it really reminded me of in terms of where it goes, but also in terms of its structure. You know, it's rare for a horror movie to go over 2 hours. But like Rosemary's Baby, this one does, and it luxuriates in that runtime. It's very slow-paced, and it revels in that. It goes for that slow burn. It really lets you know these characters. So when shit starts to go down, like, you fucking feel it. Like, it's a, like you were saying, it's a knife in the gut. And, you know, with I feel like most modern horror tends to be jump scare horror, and that doesn't usually really scare me that much. But slow burn atmospheric horror, when done really well, like, definitely does. And I think this is the scariest movie since The Witch, at least. And A24 just absolutely crushing it in the horror department. But I think I think what makes this work so well is that it plays more like an emotional drama for a good chunk of its runtime. And even then, it still felt scary during those moments. Like, I was scared about the emotions that were being felt during those sequences.
Yeah.
That seems like a different kind of problem you have.
I forgot about Babadook, to bring up as another comparison, or, you know, another movie that it evokes, which, honestly, is a movie I am too scared to finish alone. I have only seen the first half of that movie.
Oh, wait, seriously?
Yes.
I think you told me that. I thought you had finished it, though.
No, I haven't found someone to watch it yet with. So
it's got a weird ending.
So here's the thing for me,
I was about to defend the ending of The Babadook, but it's fine. Go ahead.
Okay. So here's the thing with Babadook, or with this type of horror in general, for me, that the notion that if something happens only in your mind, is it any different from if it's happening for real? That kind of psychological, your mind can manifest things that aren't there, but to your mind, it's real, and that doesn't matter if it's real or not. That is like the most, that is my deepest horror to me. So right. Movies that deal with that, like I said, shook me. So I haven't been able to finish Babadook because that's like the whole plot of that movie, or at least the first half of it. And I was like, nope, I need someone here to watch this with. So
did you even get to the part where the Babadook shows up?
Yeah. Yeah. Okay. I think it was, the scene.
He's like, hey, I'm Glenn. I live next door.
I'm a gay icon now, apparently.
Babadook, Duke. Yeah. That's my last name. It's Finnish.
Yeah. I remember the scene when I believe it's the mother in Babadook is in bed and she like sees it at the foot of her bed and she pulls the covers over her head and then you see the shadow over
God, the so thing.
And I was like, nope, I gotta go. I'm out.
Been there.
Yeah. Same. So like, someone, if you want to watch Babadook with me, let me know and I'll watch it.
Yeah, I'd do it.
Dude, I have Babadook on Blu-ray, man. We should watch it.
All right. Next horror movie.
Double feature that and game night.
Actually, that might help because we can watch Babadook first and then you can like calm yourself down with game night.
That
might work, actually. But yeah, I think what makes the movie so, like, what I really responded to, it does feel like it's taking bits of like all the best horror movies. But also particularly like the best modern horror movies. I feel like it's taking the family dynamics and the terror of the Babadook. It's taking the atmosphere of The Witch. It's taking the formal craft of The Conjuring and just kind of like throws them all together, pulls them off spectacularly. I don't know if this might be a spoiler or not. It's not really. It's happened like the first 5 minutes of the movie. There's like a Lights Out reference, right? There's like a bit where like... Okay, I just spooked Mike, sorry.
Why is this all here?
Oh my God,
who is that?
Mike is motioning behind the himself.
Sorry, I motioned to all this negative space in the frame that I'm sitting in.
This is
just move
media.
Closer to the camera.
Let me just do that. Oh, there we go. Problem solved.
Just turn the goddamn light on, Mike.
I moved into the middle of the frame. Problem solved.
Just go out, buy a lamp, get a light bulb.
I see a lamp in the frame.
Keep the sound rolling.
You want to know the best part? There's no light bulbs in that.
Oh God. And that's scary, actually. You should, Mike, if you cut out suddenly, just like text me or something, let me know.
Remember the ghost that one time?
Yeah, do we ever talk about that on the podcast? I'm not
sure
if we
ever did.
That's
a podcast history joke for anyone that
there was one time me and Mike were about to record a podcast. I think it was a film book cast. We had set up, we were getting our Skype call ready. And then suddenly like a bunch of shit started happening at once where like, my computer just suddenly crashed and went into like, it started making this weird noise and just went into like this weird white screen. While at the same time, this photo just appeared on Mike's desk of himself when he was in like seventh grade or something. And there's like some kind of power outage or something. All this happened in the span of like 2 minutes and Mike got too scared and we couldn't do the episode.
Oh, man, I swear I'm not a baby. I promise.
Mike, I think you and I have more in common than I realized prior to right now.
Yeah, Vin's actually the one who planted that photo on your desk.
Oh, mother of God.
Oh, I mean, I did, but also I startle very easily.
Okay, good. I'm glad. It's about Hereditary.
Did you like the photo, though?
It was beautiful.
Yeah, otherwise, I mean, yeah, we mentioned Toni Collette before. I really think she does give, like, a legitimately Oscar-worthy performance here. She's amazing in this movie. It's my favorite performance of the year right now. Honestly, Hereditary is probably my favorite movie of the year right now. Just throwing that out there. And, you know, I don't think she'll be nominated for the Oscars because, you know, it's tough for horror to get in there. You know, it can happen. You know, Anthony Hopkins won for Hannibal Lecter and stuff like that. But, like, it's tough for it to get in there. And so I'm sure there will be more Oscar-baity performances later on in the year that will probably get that nod. But Toni Collette really deserves some kind of recognition for this. Also, I mean, just the imagery on display. I feel like, you know, the way a scene can just suddenly turn and the way it makes you hold your breath. Like, everything about this is masterful, and the way I particularly love the way it kind of builds its own mythology by, like, just parceling out these, like, little bits of information as the runtime goes on, you know? So it's all foreshadowing towards, like, the big reveal, but, you know, it never feels like it's forced in there anything like that. It just feels like, you know, an organic part of the story, and then it all kind of pays off later on in the movie, and it's like, oh wow, like this was that, and like it all comes together. It's pretty cool.
Yeah, I really love the control of information in this movie because I feel like everything is there the whole time, and it doesn't. It somehow manages to reveal or, you know, give you the one piece of information you're missing that lets everything connect. Without feeling like an M. Night Shyamalan twist, where it's not like, oh, shit, like, and it completely changes everything about the movie, even though it does that, but it handles it like everything else in this movie. It is just the most subtle version and way to get there.
But it's also that I think it's more of a revelation, some of the things, at least for the characters, than it is for us as the audience. Because, like, I can't get into it that much.
I feel like that might be the key. What, like, the Shyamalan twist, it seems like an outside piece of information for the audience rather than makes logical sense for the characters. Yeah.
Right.
This is stuff that we kind of had, and then the characters find out, and you're like, oh.
Yeah. Right. Exactly. I will say, if there is one weak link in the movie, I would say that it is Alex Wolff, the kid who plays Peter, who, by the way, is one half of the Naked Brothers Band from Nickelodeon. Just throwing that out.
No, shut up.
Yeah, so there's that.
Crazy car is in that movie?
Yeah.
Are you kidding me?
Which is funny, because he actually drives a crazy car in the movie, but it's...
Well, okay.
It's the car itself is a perfectly normal car. It's what happens within and without of the car.
Yes.
That makes it a crazy car.
It is a crazy car in perpetuity, but not so much. That's not even how you would use that word. But
sure, Mike.
You know, just
anyway.
Like when they built it, it's a perfectly functional car,
right?
That makes sense for a family to own. That's my point.
Right, exactly. But I do think he is he's like mostly pretty good in the movie, Alex Wolff. I think there are a few scenes where he just seems like outclassed as an actor by Toni Collette and Gabriel Byrne. I almost said Peter Gabriel, which is a completely different person.
I would watch that movie though.
Yeah, like there's moments where, like, he has to act scared and he just kind of like does like the sobbing like hoo 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 and it like all right, that was great. But otherwise, like I that's really the only like nitpick I have about the movie. Like, I loved basically everything about this.
I think the only nitpick I can say, I don't even know if it's a nitpick, but I can't say it until we're into spoilery territory.
Okay, cool. So we'll get into spoilers in a second. I did want to ask you guys, how was the crowd reaction to the movie when you guys saw it?
I was in the AMC theaters, so I was very comfortable. There was a lot of people that were very comfortable.
Okay.
But have you ever been to an AMC theater?
Yeah, yeah.
By the end of the movie, me and my buddy Pat were in the two, like, the love seat, basically, that they have, and we had the armrest up, and like we were like real huddled together. Like, my hands were over my eyes, and I was like putting my one ear against his body so that was covered, and then I had my thumb like reaching around the other side of my head to cover the other ear. Spooky. That's what my audience was like.
Fair, yeah. Mike, what about you?
You know, it's real funny. There's we talked about this when we reviewed A Quiet Place, right? Where that movie in a theater with an audience could be to its detriment. Hereditary, my experience with this was a shared traumatic experience with these people. Like, we came out of this, like, just shell-shocked.
Right.
And it was so much fun. I'm so glad that there were people there that were down to yell at this movie. And it's so weird, too, because this is not one of those, like, goofy B-slasher movies where the whole point is sort of to joke around and overreact and call, like when we go see movies from the Hudson Horror Show, when we see those movies, where it's like kind of silly and we're going to yell at the movie and whatever. This is like not that. It's real. It's serious. Shit is intense. But it pulled that expression out of all of us, where we're yelling. There's scenes where, you know, I won't say what, but like where grown ass that happens. Yeah, where that happens. One time there was one moment where a grown ass dude jumped out of his seat and yelled, "Oh fuck." Like, and it was amazing. Like, yeah. And it was the best thing. And we're all like, everyone's laughing. And we're like, it's like you said, if I knew the people next to me, we would have been like consoling and hugging each other and cuddling because we were all freaked out. And it was wonderful.
Yeah, I had a similar experience. I was glad that happened because this was, you know, very much, I think, an art house horror movie. Yeah. And those tend to not get super great audience reactions in terms of mainstream audiences. I mean, this got a D+ in CinemaScore. So you know it's nice. Good.
Which makes no sense.
I mean, that's always the way it goes, though. Whenever there's like a really challenging horror movie or any kind of like movie that doesn't conform to what people expect it to be, it always gets a low rating on CinemaScore. Like, I think Mother got like an F rating, and you know, The Witch also got like a very low rating on CinemaScore. So that kind of thing. And I was expecting a crowd kind of like the crowd that we had with Mother or the crowd that I had with The Witch, where it was like, yeah, like, some people were kind of into it, but for the most part, like, they were all, like, kind of bored, or, like, they like, some of them aren't big on that, because, like, it's just not their thing, and, like, they don't really get it. Mm-hmm. Everybody in my theater was into this. Like, this seems like a really accessible art house horror movie, too, which I think is really interesting about it. Like, everybody that, like, my theater was probably about half full. My friend who I was with was basically legit having a panic attack throughout like, the second half of this movie. Like, her reaction was so visceral, and I was trying to console her at least a little bit, but also I was, like, terrified, so I was, like... was like, no help at all. And you, like, the way you're saying before, like, I am usually not for people shouting at the screen unless it does enhance the experience, in which case I feel like it did enhance it in this case, like, because everybody was having the same reaction. So it almost like relieves a little bit of tension when you hear like somebody from across the theater shout like fuck,
yeah,
and like that kind of thing.
It's very cathartic in that moment for as a group to like have that release.
Yes, exactly. Anyway, I think there's a lot of stuff we want to talk about in spoilers for Hereditary. So let's get into that right now. Let's talk about spoilers for Hereditary, starting right now.
Stop it! You're spoiling everything!
All right, it's time for spoilers for Hereditary, starting right now, guys. So I had seen the trailer for this a few times. Mike, you'd seen it once, and Vin, had you seen the trailer for this before you saw the movie?
Yes.
Okay.
And I suspected the fate of Gabriel Byrnes based on the trailer.
Yeah, I did as well. I didn't know that it was him that caught fire, but I knew it would be him that caught fire once that scene started. But that trailer does give away some of that imagery, like the fire thing. But to its credit, the fact that Charlie dies maybe like 30 minutes into the movie, not spoiled in the trailer, and
God.
Holy shit. That was, like, maybe the most brutal thing I've seen in a theater in a really, really long time.
Was it the fact that it was a little girl? Was it the fact that she was choking, like, she was asphyxiating prior to that?
Right, or the fact that she was decapitated by a road sign? Like, all those
things? Yeah, that was, it was an electric pole, okay?
Sorry.
Mike... You think they had the budget for a road sign? I'm peeking my mic like crazy right now. I gotta move back.
I think it's all those things. And it's like what Mike talked about earlier, where we just spent half an hour with this character who's possibly the main character up till this point, other than Tony.
For Act 1, she is,
Who's incredibly sympathetic, right? Just a slightly off-center, views the world through this different lens. And
well, you're saying she's sympathetic. She's also, you know, we see scenes of her, you know, chopping birds' heads off and things like that. Like, she's not like...
Yeah, sympathetic.
Okay.
Have you guys not done that?
That's fair. But I just mean it seems like Charlie is experiencing these things in a way that she doesn't comprehend, right? And in that sense, she's going through things that are way... Like, these are... It's adult emotions, right? And she's, what, 13 or something like that?
Yeah, she's a girl who's, like... She's, like, an unfortunate girl.
Yeah.
Like, who lost her grandma. Right. I don't mean unfortunate in, like, a bad way. Real quick. Just... What was the casting call for Charlie like? Were they, like, looking for girl who looks slightly off, good at clicking?
Good at clicking.
Good at clicking.
That was more of a must.
Than anything. I do know that the girl who played Charlie also originated the role of Matilda on Broadway. That's her other like big
credit. Yeah. Millie Shapiro.
Yeah, so I'm sure she has some kind of range in terms of that.
I thought she was very good. I thought her acting was fantastic.
Yeah, I know. That's what I'm saying. But I'm saying that she's not just like she's not like Charlie in real life. I think she's having like she's probably has a couple different personas that she can use in these kind of things. I doubt she played Matilda the same way she played Charlie. You know what I mean?
Oh, I hope she did. Oh, I would love to see that rendition of Matilda.
I mean, Matilda is kind of a horror movie, like if you think about it. But
yeah. You're not wrong. But yes, and then she goes through this, the most horrific death in the whole movie, I think.
Well, okay, yeah, I think the suddenness of it makes it the most horrific death in the movie.
Okay, shocking.
It's because
shocking.
She's a child, it's definitely the most shocking.
That's, yeah, yeah.
But also because she's a child who we've spent the past 30 minutes with.
Right.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's pretty messed up, and there's a lot of stuff going on there, but it also I think what I love about this movie there's a lot of like throwaway lines or character building stories that happen early on that just seem like they're there for detail or they're there to like enhance the story at the beginning but so you get to know these characters mm-hmm. a little bit more and they end up paying off in major ways like the mom sleepwalking or one of my favorites the fact that Joni's doormat looks like the ones that the grandma used to stitch. Which is a throwaway line at the beginning. And she's like, oh, wow, that's weird. It looks just like the ones my mom used to make. And something that you forget about by the end where it comes back and it turns out Joni knew her grandma, knew the mom the entire time. And it actually was her grandma.
Oh, see, that read to me, though, like right when she's like, oh, these look like the things my mom used to make. I was like, huh. That's going to come back hard.
No, I agree with that, but it is such a throwaway line. And as soon as Ann Dowd shows up, like she has to do like something. Like she has to be involved in something fucked up. Like there's no way she's not. But I'll tell you the moment that I knew this movie was a masterpiece. Like I was loving it for the first like hour and a half or whatever. Like I was super into the movie. I was loving it. And then there's that one shot after Tony Clay has been possessed, where Peter wakes up in his bed.
And
the reason I'm afraid of all that negative space right now.
Yeah. And Peter wakes up and there's so much headroom. It's like a very far away shot. You see the entire room, and you can just barely see the silhouette of Toni Collette on the ceiling in the corner, and it just holds on that shot for like 30 plus seconds, and it's motionless. You're just looking at that silhouette, and you're like, oh my god. Oh my god!
I was waiting for them to rack focus. They never did.
They never did. It's just there, and it's long enough. Like where you like at first, you might not notice it's there. Like I noticed it pretty early on. I saw it.
Yeah, I got there pretty quick.
Yeah, but maybe my favorite part about this movie, one of my favorite like cinema going experiences of all time now, I think, is watching that shot and seeing my entire theater like collectively realize that it was there.
It's when you hear the first person go. Then you're like, what did I miss?
Yeah, yeah you hear, that, I heard like one person be like, oh my god, and then like another one go, oh god, and then another one went like, oh no, until there was just like panic in the theater.
Yeah, I mean, in my theater, in that scene, that same similar thing happened. That that shot, nobody really reacted a whole lot, and then one person literally yelled, "Oh shit, the corner." And everyone went nuts. Like, the whole theater was like, oh, my God. Like, and we went nuts for 30 seconds. It was wild. Like it might be my favorite movie experience. Like, it's so silly. But
that's amazing.
Yeah. Like, it was like we were all in our living room together, and we were all friends watching this movie.
Yeah. Nice. And it's just relentless, like, from that point on. Like, that entire climax. Like, going from there, like, cutting away, like, seeing her scurrying across the wall. And, like, you see her in the corner again later on. And you see her, and you realize, like, what's about to... That's such a great like the fact that you see her at the beginning like set up in that silhouette is such a great like you saw it once you're like oh well it can't happen again and then it does happen again you're like fuck
oh no
and that second time is really long too when he's in the living room
the second time where you have Mike oh sorry Mike his screen cut out for a second
I'm here
we're to make sure you were okay
I was not taken by the
hey Mike what's that in your corner
stop
I think slightly the two scariest moments for me were. Immediately after the first silhouetted corner shot where you see that naked old man in the closet who was the guy I think from the funeral in the beginning.
That would make sense.
Because there was a guy standing next to the casket who Charlie has a moment with.
Yes. Oh yeah.
And he's got that same smile.
Yeah, you're right.
And I was something off about him in that scene, and then you see just him in the closet, and then you see his ding dong. It gets scarier as it goes.
Yeah.
But that's and then the next, which I thought was even the most disturbing, was when Toni Collette was banging her head on the attic door.
Oh yeah.
That for some reason struck such a chord with me. I don't know why, but that terrified me.
Yeah, it was an incredible shot. Like it's just a visceral shot too. Like it's just her.
Well,
they're
doing that saw thing. Oh my god! Also, the scene where she finds Charlie's body.
Oh yeah, in the attic.
I was no. That's the grandma's body.
Oh, that's grandma's body. Yeah, you're right. Oh, yeah.
The scene. More on that later.
Close up on Peter's face while his mom screams in the distance.
Yes.
Yeah, because he kills his sister, kind of. And then he just walks in the house, and you're like, yeah, kind of.
Accidentally, though.
She shouldn't have put her head out that window.
Okay.
I mean, she was choking to death, so there's a lot going on, guys. You know what? There's a lot.
He did like, force her to eat that chocolate cake.
He did. He's like, go get some of that nut cake.
Yeah. Which I want to actually. Oh, sorry, I don't know. Are you done, Ben? I don't want to cut you off. Did you have something to say about
just the guttural scream from Toni Collette? Because I was expecting like a shriek,
yeah.
But it was like this really like just from the stomach, like just gut wrenching scream, yeah. And it broke my heart.
It's nonstop for like two straight minutes because it's like that, and then it cuts to her in the room and she's like rocking back and forth, like I don't want to live anymore. And then cuts you over to the funeral and it's still screaming and crying, and it's hard to watch. It's really hard to watch, honestly.
Yeah. But I want to mention in this Charlie's death scene, before they get to the party, I didn't realize this. I don't know if you might have caught this. When they drive past the telephone pole, it lingers on the telephone pole.
It holds on the telephone pole, yeah.
Did you notice the weird, creepy, curvy necklace logo is carved into the telephone pole?
Ooh, no, I didn't.
No.
Yeah, I think. Because when I saw it, I was like, oh, that looks like there's a bunch of threes carved into there. That's weird. Whatever. That, like,
oh, yeah, they showed.
At that point in the movie, we don't know it. We haven't really seen that symbol much.
Right.
Then I got in my car. I literally closed the door in the car in the parking lot and was like, oh, shit, it was that symbol carved in the telephone pole.
I thought you were going to say you saw the symbol carved in front of you. And you're like, oh, fuck.
Yeah.
No, I put together what that symbol was. This weird cult thing, which we haven't talked about.
Right.
Oh, you mean the naked old people?
The naked old people.
Yeah.
It turns out Grandma was the leader of like a death cult kind of thing.
Right. It was very Rosemary's Baby. It was very House of the Devil. Honestly, I thought about that movie too when I was watching that.
Oh, I haven't seen that. I still want
to
watch that.
Okay, that's a pretty good. That's another one with a very slow burn. And I think it's worth it to get to the payoff, but it's not nearly as well done as this movie is.
Right on.
But I think it's a pretty solid movie. But it does have a similar ending to House of the Devil and Rosemary's Baby. Also, kind of has the same ending as The Witch, weirdly enough.
Yes, that's what I thought of
it
the most.
It does. That's actually, I was like, it's kind of like The Witch, but not so long ago.
Right.
Yeah. especially the moment after Peter has jumped out the window, right, at the very end, and he is possessed and he stands up or whatever. Or I think he's still laying down at this point. And we see Toni Collette's headless body float up into the treehouse.
Yeah.
I was like, one, terrifying. Two, I was like, oh, it's the witch with the coven. And the witches all fly away at the end.
Yeah, he gets up into the treehouse and he's possessed by Charlie. And it's very much the would you like to live deliciously moment. You know, that's basically what it is.
They're out of frame talking to him.
Pyman. He's
Payman.
He's Pyman at this point.
Payman, something like that. To backtrack, it ends with Peter throwing himself out a window to avoid the naked demon people, and he gets knocked out.
Who are
in his attic, and he gets knocked out and then possessed by Charlie, which was their plan all along. And then he follows his mom's headless floating corpse into the treehouse where Joni is waiting, along with a whole lot of headless followers, and they crown him or her, their new god, Pyman or Payman or whatever.
And then the credits roll, and you got to think, like, maybe they weren't that bad, you know?
Well, you know, it's so weird, that moment when Peter stands up and he does the tongue click.
Right.
I was like, oh, shit, it's Charlie, it's not the demon. Like, thank fuck. Like,
right.
I was so relieved in that moment, only to have the movie just, like, rip that out of it. Just like nope. Charlie was the demon by accident. Now it's oh my god.
But Charlie was the demon the whole time is the assumption, correct?
I believe that's the case, yes. So when Charlie was...
And the demon, the all-powerful demon Paimon, was allergic to nuts.
That really sounds like a Digimon's name, doesn't it?
It does.
It's Piedmon. That's what I kept thinking of the whole time. I was waiting for them to say it.
Yeah, but I mean, they talk about, right? It's another one of those throwaway lines where Charlie, in the very beginning, after the grandma's funeral, is sad, and she says, "Well, grandma always wanted me to be a boy."
Right.
Oh yeah.
Oh my god! Like, and then at the end, we find out Payman prefers a male host. I'm like, holy shit! Like, yeah. it totally changes everything when you get this reveal at the end that Charlie was the demon the whole time.
Yeah, that's at the end.
It was so good.
But what I think makes this work so well is that they establish really early on that this family has a pretty strong history of mental illness and things happening with the family. Like, the brother had schizophrenia and committed suicide, and the grandma was messed up, and the dad was messed up, and all that stuff. And so you have this kind of, the movie's called Hereditary, these hereditary traits that, you know, can pass down from you know, parent to child. And it that's, you know, it's dealing with that in a literal sense with those kind of symptoms, but then also in a metaphorical sense with this demon who's passing down from grandmother to, you know, grandchild is, it's happening there. And so I feel like it plays with that a lot. It plays like, it could just be like, you know, this is happening inside the mom's mind or something. Like, she's going nuts. She's developing those hereditary traits that her family has. But then it turns out not to sort of be the case, but also not be the case, you know?
Yeah. This one I didn't catch. I had to read an article that pointed this one out. In the group therapy scene where Annie, Toni Collette's character, is giving, like, her family, giving that family history of mental illness.
That is the exposition scene,
yeah,
I guess.
But like, to Toni Collette's credit, like, it's amazing.
Oh, yeah.
Oh, so good. Yeah. So good.
But she says her brother killed himself. He had schizophrenia or whatever, whichever. I think it might have been multiple personality disorder, whichever one.
Something along those lines.
Yeah. But anyway, and blamed his mom for trying to put people inside him.
Shit, yeah.
This movie has so many tiny throwaway references that explain that the ending explains all of it. But yeah, so that part of the movie, this is where, like, in there I'm starting to get the, oh no, I'm not going to be able to handle watching this movie, because it's is it about mental illness, and if it's real, is it different if it's not real, like, and all that, right. Like, it's hitting all of my terrifying, I can't handle these things. and then it makes the turn to, like, no, it's real. Which is, like, so fucking bold.
Yeah, that was a I gotta watch this again. Like, now I feel like we're uncovering so much, like, things from the beginning that pay off later that I didn't even think about. Yeah, so, I gotta watch,
like, that
this
scene where Gabriel Byrne is like, hey, by the way, I think your mom was the leader of a cult where they were trying to bring back a demon pie. Mom,
honestly,
he had that line, and I was like, what was that about?
Honestly, that should have tipped me off. That should have tipped me off. You're right.
Yeah.
Too busy eating my popcorn.
I have a question for your guy. What's your take, either of you, or both of you, I guess, on the miniatures and whether or not this movie is even happening at all, I guess. Because we go inside the miniature in the first opening scene, and then the movie starts.
I think that was just a stylistic choice, as far as that goes. I think the movie actually happened. Okay. I mean, if it makes you sleep better that it didn't happen, like, that's fine, you know?
Well, I mean, it's just me in my, like, madness about this movie.
Did you think it was going to be, like, a Grinch situation where it's, like, Whoville is in a snow globe?
That's a St. Elsewhere situation, I think.
It's really a Twilight Zone
right,
situation.
Yeah. Right. Yeah,
wakes
yeah,
up
yeah.
in the dollhouse.
It's a real Jacob's Ladder situation we got going on.
But, good. Yeah, like, I don't know. It's just... What? Sorry.
That's a reference to How Did This Get Made, the podcast, but yeah.
It was. Oh, it 100% was. Yeah. so good.
Yeah, I don't know. It just is one of those things that we come back to a few times. Not just the final shot, which is clearly the model of the attic, or so the treehouse with the dolls in it.
Right.
But I feel like many of the exterior shots of the house are filmed in, like, a tilt shift or something to make it look like a miniature. So I don't know. It just was one of those things where Toni Collette's character is so obsessed with crafting these things, right? It's her job. It's her, like, she's a miniature artist.
Right.
Like, and we have this looming art show that is kind of never really brought up for, I don't know why it's there, other than to add more dread.
Because art is the real monster.
The fifth element all along.
I mean, I am sure there's something to it. It was a recurring motif throughout the movie, obviously.
Yeah.
And, you know, I feel like there's more to it that I am too dumb to comprehend, but that somebody will write a great essay about, and I'll be like, oh, of course it was that.
Yes.
And I won't read it.
Yeah.
I will say there was a really funny tweet that I saw where somebody was like, honestly, the most relatable part of Hereditary to me was when the mom was answering an email about when your project's going to be done, and the scary music starts playing.
Yeah. this movie, I'm glad you brought up Mother, too, earlier, because that aspect of this movie really brought Mother to the forefront of my brain. That particularly this, there's a moment where we see I don't even know if it's there the whole movie, which is wild. There, you know, there's the miniatures that are in Annie's art studio, and then there are miniatures sort of throughout the house and like the living room and stuff like that.
Yeah. Oh yeah, they're all over the house.
Yeah, which one creepy in itself. But there's one next to the bookcase, which the camera goes to great lengths to show us the whole miniature when they're coming down the staircase. Did I say bookcase earlier? Sorry. Staircase.
Okay. Oh, is it the one where they're coming down, but it starts at the bottom and tracks up?
Yeah, meets them in the middle, and it's the miniature of the house balanced on top of collapsing houses.
Yeah.
And the first time I noticed it was right before the seance scene in the living room. Well, I don't know. It's just one of those, like, this movie is so expertly crafted, and every detail of it is perfectly designed to freak me specifically the fuck out.
Well, yeah, actually, there was the interview with the director where he was like, there's this one guy.
Long Island.
The demographic for this movie is one person.
I'm gonna fuck with Mike. And that's
His name is Mike.
I'm excited to listen to this podcast where he's just going to be, like, terrified.
Yeah.
It's going to be great. But yeah, we should talk about the seance scenes, actually. There's two big seance scenes in the movie.
Yes.
The first one with Joni introducing Toni Collette to the seance, and then the second one where they summon Charlie. And the first one I thought was, I mean, they were both really effective. The first one, though, like, felt like, I loved it so much because it felt like exactly how I would react if if I was in a seance and stuff started happening.
Yeah, for sure. One thing I'm glad they didn't do, too, and this, I think, plays into that feeling, is that as an audience, you're like, I was half expecting Joni to be like, all right, now this is going to work. And then it just not work for a while.
Right.
But pretty immediately.
Yeah.
And I think that makes it even more relatable to how Toni Collette reacts.
Right. Yeah. Like, her immediate reaction is like, what the fuck? Like, I need to get out of this right now. Like, stop it. Like, let me out. And I feel like I would be the same way. I'd be like, nope.
Yeah.
Not doing
it. Shut it down.
Yeah. Especially because somebody comes up to you, they're like, come see this seance. I'm like, yeah, all right, let's see what happens.
Yeah.
Yeah, okay, lady, let's go talk to your grandson.
Yeah, and I love that scene at least begins lit by only a match and a candle.
Mm-hmm.
And the slow fade in of the background light was awesome. But yeah, that scene was wild. I do love that, you know, in that moment, Toni Collette, Annie is just like the audience, right? Where, like you said, Mike. Like,
yeah.
Yeah, this isn't gonna, okay, whatever, it's not gonna work. And up until this point, we don't know if any of this shit's happening for real to Annie and her family, right?
Right.
This is all still, I feel like this is the third act first scene, right? Is when that, or the climax of the second act or whatever, where that happens. Where the cup moves for real, and we're like, nope, we're in fucking ghost town for the rest of this movie.
Yeah.
Was it weird that the ghost wrote I love you, but like with use? Like he did shorthand?
Yeah.
Did you guys find that weird also?
You know what? I did think that was a little odd, only because if it was just I love you and that was it, it probably would have been fine. Because it's like, you're a ghost. You're coming from very far away. You want to use up as little energy as possible. But then he also wrote Grammy. I was like, okay, you could have just said I love you. Now you're just making the message longer for no reason. You could have spelled out love and you.
Yes.
not to criticize the ghost writings of a 9-year-old, but like there is more efficient ways.
It's not his fault he's dumb. He died young.
But like that was probably payment, right? Like there's no way that was actually if she even has a son and grandson.
Yeah, true. Good point.
Oh
it was,
my God,
it was
you're
probably
right.
Charlie or payment. Yeah, you're right.
Yeah.
Payman was like, I'm going to have a little fun with this. I love you.
Grammy.
Yeah. Grammy. I got to sell this shit.
Because he's the trickster. He's a trickster guy.
Right. He's Loki, basically.
Way less charming.
Way less charming than Loki. A lot more surrounded by naked people, too, than Loki.
As far as we know.
Yeah, that's true.
As far as we know. We don't know what went on the Grandmaster's planet. You're right.
Exactly.
But and then there's the second seance scene where, Toni Collette has apparently already summoned Charlie. Like, we see that happens off screen, apparently. And so she, like, brings down Peter and the husband, Gabriel Byrne, and she makes them do the seance thing. And Peter's going along with it because he really wants to make things right with his mom because they have been, like, fighting, like, nonstop this entire movie. And it's brutal. Like
she did try to kill him when he was younger, also,
yes.
It's revealed. Sorry, I just remembered that.
That did happen as well, yeah. So there's clearly always been something off about Toni Collette's character, and which feeds into the mental illness thing of this movie. But, yeah, she doused them in, like, lighter fluid or something, or paint thinner, and and like was about to light the match and then woke up when she was sleepwalking. But yeah, then like obviously Peter feels tremendous guilt for basically killing his sister. And so he's going along with the seance thing, like trying to be like, yeah, sure, yeah. And then it happens and he freaks the fuck out. And Gabriel Byrne's like, nope, not having any of this.
Yep.
Which, because again, you think it's not going to happen. You're watching this movie with the expectation that she's going to try to do this and it's not going to work.
Yeah.
And then they're like, nope. It's going to work too well.
Yeah, yeah. And then, you know, she starts speaking in Charlie's voice and stuff like that. It's freaky, man.
Oh,
it's
freaky. Oh, did not like that.
Yeah, and I think that scene, at least up to a point, is one take from when they come down the staircase.
A lot of the scenes in this movie are, like, just one take, or, like, really long takes.
Which adds to the slow burn, oh, my God, something terrible is coming tension right. For so much of this movie. Mike, why'd you make me see this?
I think we've successfully broken Mike's Creatio, so that's great. The entire goal of this podcast.
Oh, God, our plan.
Who thought it would be this one and not The Complete Works?
Right.
Interesting.
Yeah, interesting. So, yeah. Who would have thought, like, making you watch, like, hundreds of Cage movies wasn't going to destroy you? This is the one that did. Other stuff in the movie. So many decapitations. Guys, so
yeah, the bird thing really starts a long-running trend.
Yeah, the bird is really the foreshadowing of obviously Charlie gets her head knocked off in the car, we didn't mention this, but just the shot of her head on the street, like, ugh. Yeah,
oh, with the ants,
it's so gross.
And then like later on in the movie, when in the climax, when they have her head on the like the dummy,
yeah,
with the crown,
oh man,
yeah.
It's fucked. It's fucked, man. But yeah, so that there's that. But then, you know, obviously you see like the naked people that are also decapitated. And then Toni Collette floating in the air and cutting off her own head. Ah!
I love that after he jumps out the window, you hear the...
Yes!
And then like the thud of her head hit it.
Yeah.
Just from a sound design standpoint, that was done so well.
So good.
Like that I feel like could have been done in a way that made it funny. Not like that would be, but you know what I mean? Like that sort of sound effect where you're like, that sounded cheesy.
Like it could have been like, boing.
Exactly. Yeah, like, rrr, bump.
Yeah. And like the payoff of the broken piano, right? Like,
yeah.
There's that scene, right? Earlier in the scene where it's like this classical piano crescendo crash when right before Peter comes down the stairs, then the climax at the end. And like, oh, it's the piano is knocked over. Which, like, okay, that explains that kind of funny horror trope moment. And she uses a piano wire. That's what she's using to cut her head off.
Yeah, man.
Yeah.
It's really, I mean, this
fuck.
This feels almost like an Edgar Wright film where everything is a setup. Like, everything is set up and paid off spectacularly, you know?
The only thing we didn't get to see, and honestly, if they ever made a sequel to this movie, this is the story I'd be interested to
Hered
see.
Hereditary?
Hereditary. Running in the family.
The sequel to this is Ratatouille.
Yes. Of course. Yeah. But it's there's this girl that Peter has like a crush on. Yeah.
Right.
And he goes to her party. And just like imagine the movie from that girl's point of view. Like that's the film I want to see where she's like, there's this kind of cute guy who came to my party and then his sister ate some nut cake and then she got decapitated and then he smashed his face on a desk and broke his nose in front of everybody and then he disappeared forever.
Oh my God.
That's the story I want to see told.
Yeah, the Hereditary sidequel that explains her story. I'm into it.
Yep.
Definitely into it. All right, I think we should probably wrap this up because we've been talking for a while. Is there any final thoughts about Hereditary that you guys want to impart on the listeners today?
Oh, okay. So,
all right.
Oh yeah, you had a story, Mike.
I had a story, right? So I saw this Sunday night, came home, was getting ready to go to bed. Nope, a lot of dark corners in my room. Scared instantly. No matter what, I got four corners even actually, all of them dark. Scary times. And I had a empty water bottle on my nightstand, right? And I had my fan on. And the fan on oscillate. At one point, I was half asleep. Like, it must have been, like, 1:30, 2 in the morning. I figured out in the morning. Blew the empty water bottle off the nightstand. And it landed cap first on the metal base of the lamp next to my bed, which surprisingly sounds like freaked me the fuck out. I swear to God, I woke up like boom, awake. That was it. Like I basically slept for like 2 to 3 hours Sunday night.
Oh my God.
That's horrific. Sorry, my darling mother brought me a water.
Nice. I'm jealous.
Oh yeah, man.
Terrified.
That's crazy.
Yeah. That's...
I'm so sorry you went through that, Mike.
Damn.
But anyway, yeah. So it sounds like the movie spooked you good.
Yeah. Yeah. This is probably a movie I won't ever forget, I don't think.
Yeah.
Changed my life.
Yeah. I'm also a huge fan of this movie. I love this movie to death. I think it is probably my favorite movie of the year right now. And I'm not sure. Like, I can't. Like, I hope there's another movie that can unseat it, because, like, that would be great if I saw a movie that's better than Hereditary. But I.
Maybe Book Club.
Maybe Book Club. But at the same time, like, I'm not sure if it's... Like, this movie really got to me. And really, like, I just loved watching every second of it, and I was terrified, and so... It's so good. Like, I so rarely get scared by a horror movie, like, at this point, because I've seen so many of them in my life, and so to have one like this that really gets under my skin, it's always really good. So, that is Hereditary, the new movie from A24. I'm really excited to see what director Ari Aster does next, because this movie... I can't wait. I just need him to make 10 more movies that are just like this. Maybe the sidequel about the the stoned girl.
But the girl,
yeah. But maybe something else. Yeah, who knows?
Just please don't make a Hereditary. I don't want this to become another horror franchise later on.
Right.
Like, I don't want there to be a two that's okay, and then like a 3, 4, 5, 6 that are dumb. Like, I don't want this movie to be ruined. Don't sully the Hereditary name.
Yeah, fair.
Yeah.
I mean, so far, A24 hasn't really been going for that.
Yeah, I know. That's true.
You know, so I think...
I'm just afraid.
I don't think it'll happen. I think, you know, The Witch could totally have a sequel, but it hasn't made one yet, so...
That's true.
Well, in a way, I like to think this is the sequel to The Witch.
Oh, yeah. Maybe they're the same universe. Maybe they're the same...
There's an 824.
The A24CU.
Yeah, maybe it's the same demon who's just renamed over the years or whatever. Like, he was Black Phillip and now he's Paimon or whatever.
Also, sorry, I know we gotta wrap this up, but how are you supposed to watch The Witch and they have a goat named Black Phillip and the whole... Like, how was that family not immediately like, it's the goat. The goat is the problem.
We have to get rid of this goat.
Yeah. Oh my God.
Anyway, yeah. So I think that about wraps up our discussion of Hereditary. Guys, where can we find you online this week? Vin, let's start with you. Where are you available on the interwebs?
I am available, as always, at youtube.com/Krebuland Productions. I also have my own YouTube channel under Vin Craig, I think. I don't really post to that one.
Okay.
But exciting news, I have my own podcast in the works.
Okay.
Which I'm very excited about. It should be premiering in a month or so.
Nice.
We have not recorded the first episode yet. That is going to happen in 2 weekends, I want to say.
Okay.
It is called Bar Fight, and I am very excited about it.
Cool. Can you say anything about the podcast, or is it just the name?
I can say that we are going to be taking categories... And such as, I don't know. I want to say it, but I don't know how much I can say. Yeah, we're gonna be taking categories such as like presidents, athletes, serial mascots, perhaps.
Okay.
And we're going to be drafting teams of them to be on our team in a bar fight.
Okay, that sounds like a really cool podcast. And where can we be able to find that? Like iTunes, Stitcher, and stuff like that, like the usual podcast places.
I don't know, man. You and I got to talk about that often. You got to help me out a lot.
All right. Yeah, fair enough.
But who knows? Maybe we'll do a Nick Cage episode.
Ooh, yeah. Now that would be exciting. If there's
Cage match.
There's two people who know a lot about Nicolas Cage. It's these guys.
It's you two and Nicolas Cage.
That's it.
Yeah, that counts as two people. Three of
us. God, that was a terrible plug, I feel like.
No, that was a good plug. We're all excited for Bar Fight.
Oh, right on.
Looking forward to it. And you can follow you on Twitter.com, or Twitter at, Vin Craig? Vin J. Craig? What was it?
At Vin Craig. I think on Twitter, I am... I'm not...
You're right.
I think I'm the champagne of men.
You're right. This is a terrible plug.
This is so bad.
It's okay. The champagne of men is your handle, but what's your at? What's your
at? At Vincent J. Craig.
At Vincent J. Craig. Okay.
Yeah.
All right, good.
On Twitter and the gram.
Gotcha. All right, Mike, what do you got? Where can we find you online?
You can find me at MD Filmblog on Twitter.
All right. And you can find me on Twitter at MSmithFilmBlog. All of our podcasts and stuff at filmbook.com. You can hear me on the radio on WPDH and WRRV. Mike, what are you laughing at now? What is happening?
You guys are so good at plugs. I gotta up my plug game so bad.
Well, one, it's still hilarious that we say at our Twitter names now somehow. It's still hilarious to me. And two, just Finn's reaction was great. Sorry. Okay. Everything's bad right now.
All right. Anyway, thank you so much for listening to Film Bookcast. I'm Mike Smith. That's Mike DiCriscio and special guest Vin Craig. If you're listening to this review via our podcast on iTunes, subscribe to the podcast, rate it, take a moment to give us a review. Any and all feedback, compliments, topic discussions, even hate mail can be sent directly to podcast@filmbook.com. Please list the podcast you're emailing about in the title of your email, because we produce just so many different ones, hard to keep track. We would love to hear from you. Now join us for the next episode of Film Bookcast, where Mike, we got to talk about what we're reviewing, because it's either going to be Incredibles 2 or Jurassic World Fallen Kingdom, and I am going to see both. Incredibles 2 will be the good one, definitely. Yeah. So it really depends on what you like. I think a review of Jurassic World will be really fun.
I think that's what it's going to be. Just it's going to come down to how mad I am at the world and whether or not I want to enjoy a thing or be pissed off at it.
Okay, so
can I come back for the tag episode?
I'm going to go out on a limb and say we're not doing a tag episode.
Oh. What about book club? Are you guys going to do a book club episode?
We're doing a special bonus book club episode, so yeah, so you can jump in on that one. Nice. So yeah, we'll do either Incredibles 2 or Jurassic World, depending on what Mike's mood is. We'll figure that one out later. And you can check out our next Complete Works, where we are talking Nicolas Cage's role in 2011's Drive Angry. Very excited to revisit that movie. It has been a long time. And all right, so thanks again, Vin, for coming on the show. Always,
thanks for having
me. A blast. Hope to have you again soon. And thank you so much for listening, guys. We are out.